Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Business Brew. I'm your host, Bill Brewster. This episode features Jay Mintzmyer. He's come back for a repeat appearance on the Business Brew. Jay is one of the best shipping analysts out there, and he runs Value Investor's Edge on Seeking Alpha. Jay came back to discuss more logistics issues and opined on a number of shipping stocks. Thank you to Jay for joining again. I appreciate it. I think this will help round out some of the logistics picture when listened to in conjunction with Craig Fuller's episode. This episode is sponsored by Bastier Partners, a boutique investment bank. Bastier's founder and managing member is Nader Afshar, a fan of the pod. As I've said previously, Nader is described as a connector, high integrity, a low-key version of Byron Trott, and the rare investment banker that focuses on the alignment of interests and incentives. I appreciate Nader and Bastier's support. As always, none of this is financial advice. All of the information contained in this program is for entertainment purposes only. Please consult your financial advisor before making investment decisions and do your own due diligence.
So Jay Mintzmyer, for a return appearance on the brew. Thank you for coming. Actually, I have to refer to it as the Business Brew, I think, per some copyright issue that I had.
Fair enough. So, it's good to be back.
How's everything going, man? I think this will come out in like two Thursdays.
Okay.
So we are currently recording on a day that the market is like crashing.
Yeah.
You seem calm.
Yeah. You know, May 5th and, you know, shipping and energy are my two areas, mainly shipping and energy related. And normally shipping and energy have like a 1.5 to 2.5 times beta on bad days. So that means, you know, the market's down 3-4%. We're down 8, 9, 10. And today we're only down half as much as the market. So I'm actually, I hate to say happy, but I'm fairly relaxed today.
Yeah. Shipping has been interesting. I had Craig Fuller on, and I'm interested in all things logistics now. I guess I didn't know that I would be, but I do enjoy it. And saw some pictures on Twitter of boats in China that were completely stuck in the ocean. And I thought, you know, maybe Jay can make some of this news make sense, and we can have a good conversation. And I enjoyed your Money Show presentation very much.
Yeah, well thanks, thanks, Bill. And it's definitely timely. It's been a few months since we talked, and things are just as crazy as ever, if not crazier, right? Especially after this Ukraine situation. I mean, it's just, you know, we thought the craziness part was last summer. And it looks like, especially in tankers and dry bulk markets now, we're just getting started on some of the disruptions.
I mean, how would you characterize, for those that haven't watched the Money Show presentation or aren't familiar with what's currently going on, how would you set the stage?
Well, first of all, we had a once-in-a-generation disruption with COVID-19 and the global shutdowns that occurred, all the lockdowns, and the corresponding shift of consumers shifting to goods and items, upgrading their houses and their home offices and that sort of thing, coupled with all the mess we had out of China. You have the world's largest exporter, which is also going through its own series of lockdowns. And that sort of forced shutdown and restart just completely slammed the global logistics industry. The last 20 years have been built on, yes, increasing global trade, but sort of this just-in-time inventory management. And that's not just consumer goods. That's a lot of the ways the oil supply works, gasoline, diesel, jet fuel, all that stuff. As sort of a, you know, just-in-time inventory and steady flows. And we're not used to these disruptions. So that was sort of the backdrop to what we saw last year in 2021, which was the global economy restarting and such a jam at the ports, not enough ships available, not enough trucks available, all that sort of stuff happened. That was on the container ship side. And there was congestion across the board, but the container ship side is really what got the most focus. You know, when folks see their prices going up at Walmart, that hits their attention pretty fast. Folks want to order new furniture. They had to wait 6 months on back order, very high visibility. And then it became a political item too last fall. Now what we're seeing is a little bit less on the consumer goods side, on the container ship side, but the war in Ukraine has caused a lot of disruptions around the Black Sea and gasoline flows, oil flows. Everyone's probably noticed the higher oil prices. But what hasn't got as much discussion yet is the actual logistics of how the world is going to resource a lot of that oil and those trade flows. And we'll get more into it, Bill, but one of the really interesting things we've seen recently is the spike in jet fuel specifically. Folks look at oil prices and yeah, they're a lot higher, but they've moderated around, you know, 100, 105, 110 per barrel. They're not skyrocketing. Jet fuel, completely different. It is skyrocketing. It has went up week over week over week for 3 months straight. And that's something that I think is really going to grab folks' attention as we enter the summer travel season.
I have certainly noticed it some on ticket prices. It'll be, I think people will probably spend through it just because they've been locked up for so long, but it'll be interesting to watch. I thought it was funny when we were talking offline, I said to you, well, you know, with this oil disruption, I would think that tankers would be where you'd want to be. And like anyone that has been around for a while, you said, well, that's a good first order thought, but it's already priced in, basically. You want to tell people sort of what is going on with the logistics market around oil, first of all?
Certainly will do, Bill. And I just want to caveat, and I might be incorrect. I got a, you know, historical revisionism or something, but I think we were talking about LNG tankers, liquefied natural gas.
Sorry.
That was the one that was already priced. I think at that time, actually, the product tankers, Scorpio Tankers, stock symbol STNG, is the most liquid. And I do have a long exposure to that name, just so everyone knows. But I was buying around that time. So just to be clear, when we were talking about stuff that was priced, it was the LNG trade. And those were the stocks that skyrocketed right away, as they should have. But by the time people were talking about it, it was kind of too late. So with that caveat placed, just so I got my tanker commentary right, look, what's going on with the oil tankers? Well, first of all, and again, Billy, I know you saw the money show, so a lot of that was covered, and that presentation is available on YouTube. So whenever this podcast is up, if there's ability to link that, I think that would also help.
Yeah, I'll put it in
folks.
The show notes.
Yeah, because I mean, I had the benefit of slides and stuff to point to. But the big disruption that's going to happen with crude tankers, and it's just getting started, is if the EU steps forward and completely embargoes Russian oil. There's been talk around that. Germany was a big opponent to the full embargo of Russian oil. They have stepped back. They have said they no longer oppose that. So if that happens over the next couple of months, we're talking about 2 million barrels of Russian oil that needs to be relocated. And they're going to have to take that oil and ship it seaborne out of the western part of Russia over to places like India and China. And that's a significantly longer distance for seaborne oil. It can be up to 8, 9, 10 times further. It probably, by the time you incorporate port delays, things like that, we're probably talking 4 to 5 times boost in ton miles for that particular route. And that's 2 million barrels. And that's, you know, global demand is around approaching 100 million barrels a day. So yeah, you know, 2% of that, right? But you take 2% of that, well, you know, and that's 2% of total. It's probably 5% of ocean going. And 5% of ocean going oil is going to have its distance increased by 4 to 5 times. Because the way to measure demand for oil tankers is not just by volumes, right? It's by volumes and by time. Like, how long is it going to take those ships to reroute? So little changes, and we've seen this before. We saw it with COVID-19. Little changes, 4, 5, 6% can have global massive impacts. And so what we're expecting to see is if that 2 million barrels of oil gets fully rerouted and Europe has to replace that 2 million barrels of oil with not neighboring Russia, they're going to have to pull from the United States exports. We're starting to see that already, where they're going to have to pull from Brazil. So think of how much further that is, right? U.S. Gulf, Brazil. And so you have two different push and pulls happening at the same time. We don't have enough crude oil tankers available for that kind of action. It could be a crazy market. It could be just like container ships, only for oil tankers.
And am I correct that, let's see, I actually have some of your service up right now, but James Catlin just wrote something about how thin the order books are. Is that in tankers as well?
Yes, that's across dry bulk and oil tankers in particular. Those are the two segments that have very small order books. Of course, container ships, because of what's happened the last 2 or 3 years, is a very, very fat order book. Everybody's been building new container ships. So when you look forward to, say, 2024, 2025, oil tankers and dry bulk are looking extremely undersupplied. And tankers, you know, it depends on how long this sort of disruption and embargo lasts. And you also have to assume or figure that the global demand is going to be steady. So if there's some sort of like global recession and oil demand crashes, then that sort of super catalyst is kind of off the table, right? You have to have that steady recovering to 2019 plus levels. So you have to see that steady, you know, 100 million per day global demand, if not higher. You also have to see OPEC continue to increase their exports. You have to see China move past the zero COVID. So there's a lot of things in play, Bill. It's not a sure thing. This is more of I'm telling folks, you know, hey, pay attention, right? Look at some of these oil tanker companies that are cheap, that are a little undervalued, and consider that as a bullish catalyst. I'm not saying 100% that's going to happen, but this is probably the most constructive and exciting, I would even say exciting, I've been about oil tankers in, I mean, probably since 2020 when we had that crazy oil storage boom.
Yeah, that's right, because people were using the tankers as storage, right? Because all the physical storage was all completely spoken for, right?
Yeah, completely full. But that was such a short-lasting thing, right? And we had a similar thing, Bill. I don't know if you followed it back then. Most folks didn't. Back in 2019, there was a similar thing that happened when Costco is like a Chinese shipping company, COSCO, not to be confused with
not the Valley Costco, Club but Costco. Yeah.
You're not getting big jars of peanut butter, right? anyways, there was these huge sanctions that went down on Costco, which was a Chinese shipping company. It related to dealings with Iran and stuff like that. And the U.S., it was almost, I wouldn't say a misstep or a mistake by the U.S., but I think they didn't quite think through the ramifications of their sanctions. They were trying to punish a Chinese company, and they didn't kind of think through the ramifications of, oh, wow, we're going to hit like 500 tankers with these sanctions.
Yeah.
And because they were just trying to, you know, apply a little pain, and they ended up punishing the entire global oil supply. So my point being, Bill, was back in 2018, we saw a huge spike in tanker rates too, but that was short-lived. It was related to a sanction. It only lasted for about 4 months. We had the floating storage, short-lived. It lasted about 2 months, 3 months. So if we're going to have this global rerouting of Russian crude oil, how long is it going to last? Is it just a 2 or 3 month thing and then Ukraine hits a peace deal and then it's over? Or is this a multi-year thing? If it's a multi-year thing and Ukraine's not resolved for 4 or 5 years, then you know this could be a super cycle. And so it's way too early to say.
I wonder if, you know, the Ukraine situation is quote unquote resolved. If, you know, I don't know. I think I'd be interested to see if everybody says, okay, let's just go back to how things were. It seems to me that even with a resolution could have some long ramifications.
It's a tough situation, dangerous situation, scary. You know, I don't want to get over my skis too far talking about potential Ukraine outcomes, but it's hard to imagine with the amount of Western support that Ukraine has received and with the, you know, victories in the media and the press and all that, it's hard to imagine Ukraine accepting a peace settlement that's not at least better than the prior status quo, right? I mean, we might even have Crimea might even be somewhat back on the table, and that was unthinkable a month ago. And so it's a scary situation. I don't think either party is in a position where they can accept a sort of a status quo peace deal at this point.
Yeah, and it seems to me too that if nothing else, this has brought to the forefront Europe's reliance on Russian energy and whether or not that's a good idea. So I mean, obviously it's sort of like how much pain are you running to versus what kind of pain are you running from? I think would be some of the calculation, but it's not unfathomable to me to see a world where there's more moving of oil on tanker ships.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a critique of sort of kind of a U.S.-led critique, I would say, of the European Union and NATO for a decade now. I think President Trump was probably the most vocal about it and probably received a lot of pushback for it. But a fact of, you know, European defense budgets being small and shrinking really post-Cold War, and Russian gas imports and oil imports surging post-Cold War. And, you know, part of that's this globalization, and you should, you know, want to trade with your neighbors and develop strong ties. But, you know, this Ukraine situation, starting with Crimea, right, in 2014, but really now, I mean, Crimea was kind of your wake-up call, right, your first alarm going off. But in this situation, you know, you have a lot of nations who have sort of sleepwalked into this situation, and, you know, defense budgets are down and dependence on Russian energy is up, and that's, that cannot maintain. And we've already seen it. We've already seen lots of countries increasing their defense budgets. We've already seen certain countries, Poland was one of them, some of the Baltic states are another, who are a little bit further ahead of the curve, right? They were a little more defense oriented. They had already started investing in LNG and alternatives like offshore wind, and they're getting, they're pulling away from Russia a little bit faster. Germany is one of the countries that it's going to be really difficult for Germany to replace that natural gas. Maybe they can do the oil. That natural gas is going to take, I would argue, years for them to fully transition away from Russia.
Hmm. Yeah, interesting. Interesting web.
Yeah, that's the thing about shipping
incentives.
Folks aren't always interested in shipping stocks because it's a small corner of the market. And, you know, I work with some global funds and such who can't really invest in shipping directly because the market caps are too small. But when you are thinking about the global geopolitics and the global macro, you have to think about these trade lanes and you have to think about the moving pieces. And I think that's what makes shipping so exciting and interesting. And I think it's a conversation that no matter what part of the market you're involved in, you can learn something, right, by paying attention to what's going on in global shipping and what's going on with global trade flows.
Yeah, when I talked to Craig, he said, normally if people are hearing about me, that means that things are broken. Right. Logistics are not something that's super sexy most of the time. But, you know, now that I have gotten interested in it, it's really nuts. Like it's so complex, but then it works so well. It seems like 85% to 90% of the time. But then when it breaks like it is, it seems like it's, you know, not something that you can just flip on and get back to maximum efficiency, it doesn't seem like.
Definitely not. And just to pivot real quick, because I pitch shipping as something everybody should be interested in just for, you know, global, you know, knowledge and fascination. But on the more micro side, if you're trading or investing in shipping stocks, I think the best part about this industry is that the first gut reaction, common sense, is usually wrong. And I'll give you one quick caveat. And right after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, I had several folks reach out to me and friends of mine, not shipping investors, personal friends of mine and fellow students here in my program. And they said, you know, oh, this Russian invasion of Ukraine, like the airspace is shut down, like, you know, trade is stopping, like ships are embargoed. This is gonna be terrible for you, Jay, isn't it? Like, this is really bad for shipping. I was like, no. Like, it's actually really good for shipping. Like, disruption's good. Like, it's going to slow the ships down. Like, I had to be careful with my language because I would hate to hesitate, you know, associate a conflict with being positive, right? But in terms of the shipping economics, disruption is always favorable. But most folks look at disruption and think, you know, it's bad. So, like, a lot of shipping stocks went down after the Russian invasion of Ukraine for a few days, which created an exceptional buying opportunity. We saw the same thing in 2020 with COVID. Now, during March, like, I don't fault anybody for selling any stocks in shipping, but it became very obvious over the summer, obvious to us, right? Obvious to folks who follow the industry closely, became very obvious by like July and August as the global economy was reopening that shipping was in an amazing position. I didn't know how good, I was bullish on shipping, Bill, and I didn't see the container ship rates going this high, right? Like, I mean, yeah. It exceeded my wildest expectations. But my point is that common sense in the middle of 2020 was not saying throw all your eggs in the shipping basket, right? That's why the understanding of this industry, and I'm probably selling it too hard here, but the understanding of this industry can be fascinating for people who don't even want to be involved because they, you know, they have too big of a fund or they don't want to trade shipping stocks. And it can be profitable for those who have, you know, more nimble accounts and want to get in there and trade those stocks.
Yeah, well, you're a guy that, I mean, you've dedicated a long time to this. You did it before it was sexy, right? So you're allowed to pitch it now. You're not a Johnny come lately.
Yeah, I've been here a while, man. It's crazy getting old just thinking about it. But yeah, it's been about 12 years.
So some of the fragility, I guess let's close the loop on this, the oil tanker discussion. So let's say there is a recession, you know, how are you thinking about downside risks here and kind of what could go wrong and how to protect against that?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. It absolutely needs to be asked. And, you know, that's another sort of caveat or interesting thing about shipping is that it's really like six or seven subsegments. So we talked a little bit about the oil tankers and why I'm interested there and why there's some potential catalysts. We also have dry bulk, which is very heavy iron ore, coal, grains, things like that. We have the container ships, which I think pretty much everybody knows about after last year. So we have all these different subsegments. And so when I think about a global recession and a slowdown and what that means, first of all, what type of recession is it? Is it global, right? Or is it, you know, US centric? Is it European? Is it China, right? Is there, you know, endless zero COVID things that bring that economy down a little bit, but the rest of the world is slowly recovering? Like, what are the areas, right, that are impacted? And, you know, I think most folks think of a consumer recession in the United States, right? And so that sort of impact would be very hurtful, I think, for container ship rates, right? The freight rates and things like that. So if someone is worried about a global recession, especially a US-centric consumer recession, which is what most of us think about, you want to be really careful with companies that have a lot of exposure to freight rates, especially container ship freight. Companies like a big favorite of mine, I'm long it right now in a trade position, a Zim Integrated Shipping. It trades at about 1.5 times earnings. And if you strip out the cash, it's arguably less than 1 times earnings. And I think that's attractive. I think it's a good trade right now, but it doesn't come without risk, Bill. And because that's the kind of company that if we hit a recession, you know, you're going to maybe get that 1 times earnings and then you're kind of done. Then earnings are flat and they might even be a little bit negative. So if you're concerned about a recession, you don't want to be putting large percents of your portfolio into very risky stocks like that. You want to be looking at stocks that either have contracted backlog for several years, so the near-term spot rates don't really hurt you very much, or you want to look into segments where a recession or a slowdown is kind of already priced into the stock. And so that's why with shipping, again, different segments, different things. You know, if there's a global recession coming, you know, I think some of the niche trades, like for example, product tankers right now, are probably going to be just fine. I mean, if it's GFC, global financial crisis level, you know, the stocks are going to hit, right? Every stock's going to hit. But if you're talking about the underlying cash flows and the underlying situation, something like product tankers, something like LNG, that's not going away, right? People, the power plants are still going to be running. People are still going to be heating their homes. That sort of trade is very steady. So hopefully that makes sense, Bill. It's a complex answer, but that's the great thing about having six or seven subsegments and 50 or 60 stocks to pick from.
No, that does make sense to me. With Zim, you had said that people compared it to WeWork, the bears did. Do you mind explaining the business model there, what they do, and kind of why that comparison? Because obviously, to your point, when you hear 1 times earnings, the market's basically saying, like, fine, maybe you can suck 1 year of super normal profits, but then the rest, like the terminal value is basically zero, right?
That's exactly.
Or negative.
That's exactly. I mean, yeah, the market is basically saying that you're going to get maybe like 1 year out of this thing and then it's worthless, which, of course, I don't agree with. That's why I'm long. But there is some logic to that. I'm not going to come on today and say the bears are all idiots or whatever. The WeWork comparison, I've mentioned that's been cited by bears. It's been cited by bears since Zim was like $20 a share. So it was a little bit of a lazy analogy and not quite correct. But there are, again, there's always truth in things, right? I mean, usually when you hear some sort of outrageous statement, there's a little bit of truth in it. WeWork, and I'm not a WeWork expert. Just that was a terrible company, business model, poor leadership, poor management. What other state can I impale them on?
I think that at the end of the day, the commonality that people see is they're leasing space and then leasing it again, right? So you've got a long lease and then you're trying to fill it with
that's
short
exactly.
leases.
And Bill, that's exactly the parallel. I just had to make sure I talked a lot of
I'm not saying that it's like a fraud or whatever.
Yeah, that's, I had to make sure what we were talking about. No. So the issue with Zim is that they are chartering in all their tonnage, all their ships. They only own about 8 ships out of a fleet of around 120. So over 90% of their fleet is leased in. And the lease durations remaining are between about a year left and up to 5 years. They've also signed on a lot of new builds that come online between mid-23 and early 2025, which are fixed on like anywhere from 7 years to 12-year contracts. So Zim's cost structure is a lot of fixed costs in there. Basically, all their ship operating stuff is fixed. It's all leases. Now it rolls off. It's not fixed forever. And those new builds are actually going to bring down their fuel cost, and it's going to bolster their efficiency. But their cost structure is fixed, really, for 2022. In 2023, the cost structure is similarly fixed, very high levels. Oh, not only that, you have oil prices going up. So, I mean, the fixed parts are fixed high, and the variable expenses are almost purely oil and a little bit of labor. Well, with inflation, you got labor going up. With the oil price environment, you got oil prices going up. So Zim's cost structure is it's not ideal, right?
Yeah, because then if you get weakness in the container ship market, they still have to make these payments, but they've got a lot less money coming in.
Exactly, Bill. And look, I'm long Zim. I have, you know, all the incentive to come on here and say nothing but good things about it, but that's, you know, not the way I operate, right? There's risk in the model, and the freight rates are partially.
So do you control that? Wait, real quick. Do you control that with like a sizing, or do you say, you know what, like I'm so on top of this market that I'll basically be the first one out?
Well, that's always dangerous if the first one out is your logic. But
yeah, no. I know it's dangerous, but that doesn't mean people don't play the game.
Yeah. So there's I guess a three-pronged approach. And I got to be careful when I say three, because I always start a list and forget the third one. But
I'll count them for you. Let's go. One.
Yeah. So the most important thing about this, Bill, is having an attractive entry pricing, an attractive discount to what you believe, based on whatever model you want to use, is a fair value. And right now, I believe Zim's fair value is about $75 a share. I think that's pretty conservative, but that's what I'm comfortable paying for Zim, is $75. So back in March, I actually got out of Zim. It was the first time I was out of Zim in 13 months. I was long that thing since the day after IPO. And of course, the size varied, right? I had option trades, bolstering, and things like that. But I was long some form of Zim for 13 months. In March, it went over what I believe was a fair value. And I sold, and I told folks publicly, Twitter, I said, hey, look, I've been long this thing 13 months, but it's no longer attractive to me. We saw it fall past 75. We saw it fall through 65. And I said, all right, I'm going to wait for some sort of trough, some sort of support. As long as it's sufficiently below that 75, I'm comfortable getting long again. Now that's part one. Now, part two is what you alluded to, is the sizing, right? And my sizing is pretty basic. The more below the fair value it is, the larger the size is going to be. So if Zim is 71.50 and my fair value is 75, it's going to be a small position, like a percent or two, right? If I believe the fair value is 75 and Zim is 54, which is where it was when I got back in, it's going to be a little bit larger. Now, it didn't go lower than 54, so I didn't get like Jalen Smart's supersized position, but I would say moderately long Zim. So that's part two. And then part three is sort of what you alluded to, is sort of looking at the cycles and seeing where we are and seeing where the trends are blowing. But it's not just, I can't just rely on part three alone. And one of the reasons why is because it's like rats fleeing a ship, and pun intended, I suppose, with Zim. But if you're getting in something purely thinking you're going to beat other people out, you've seen how Zim trades, Bill. I mean, it's so cyclical. So you really have to incorporate those potential bearish outcomes before you decide to buy the stock. And if you're a day trader, like, you know, you do you, right? Like, I don't day trade, but like, if you're just going to buy this thing for a couple hours or maybe like one day overnight, then yeah, you can play those games. But if you're going to have a position like I do, which is ideally, you know, 6 months, 12 months, you gotta really understand where that value is. So I guess three things there. Hopefully I got all three of them.
Yeah, you got all three. I was counting.
All right.
So how do you get comfortable with the back end cash flow risk?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, Bill. So the reason why I'm really comfortable with Zim is because I understand how their cost structure is shifting. You know, I understand that 2023, I would say late 22, early 23 is going to be the peak of their cost structure. But starting in mid-23, a lot of the legacy charters of these older ships roll off. So those ships they paid record amounts for, 70, 80,000 a day, are going back to the owners. And the new builds are starting to come online. And those new builds are either eco-design, which means they save in this environment, they save about $15,000 to $20,000 per day in bunker fuel expenses, or they're LNG dual fuel, which not only will save them money on fuel expenses, will also qualify them for the latest environmental standards. They won't have to spend extra money upgrading their ships in the next 5 or 10 years. So that's why I'm more comfortable, I think, Bill, with the back end, is that I understand this cost structure is not going up in a straight line. The cost structure is already peaking. I would say late 22, maybe Q1 23 is the peak cost structure. So that's part one. Part two of why I'm comfortable at this point is that starting May 1st, we're recording May 5th, so this just happened. Starting May 1st, Zim just rolled all of their contract fleet onto new rates at anywhere between, and they haven't disclosed the exact number, but anywhere between 100 and 150% above last year's contract volumes. And that's 50% of their...
This is what they're charging their customers.
Exactly. And that's, and I should have said this first, Bill, there's two parts to their freight. It's not true that all their freight is like WeWork. It's not all spot. 50% of their freight approximately on the Trans-Pacific. Trans-Pacific is Asia, US, basically, the Trans-Pacific. 50% of that is fixed. So that's contract business. It's usually about 1 year in duration that rolls over every year. This year was so strong that Zim was actually able to fix some of that contract business for maybe two and a half years. That's never been seen. Like, that's never happened before.
Yeah, that's right. Because I did listen to the earnings call and what they said, that they were, that customers were asking them to extend the duration so that they had certainty of availability, right?
Exactly. And these are customers like Walmart or Home Depot, companies like that, that are very reliable. Right. It's not your small, you know, mom and pop import business or you know, flip, that sort of thing. It's very stable companies like, again, like Walmart or Home Depot or Costco, like we mentioned.
Yeah.
So, you know, that freight business is very steady. And so it's not like all spot in that case. The other 50% is indeed spot. And those rates can go all over the place. They've been remarkably strong and stable throughout the entirety of this year. I'm shocked by how strong they've been. But that's the riskier part, that 50% spot, Bill. If we see a consumer recession, and I'm not saying I believe that it's going to happen, but if you believe that's a viable risk, that spot rate can go down almost immediately. And so that is a viable risk for Zim. But Bill, because I understand where the cost structure is going, and because I understand the percent they have on fixed charters, or excuse me, fixed freight contracts, I'm not too worried about it. I don't see a colossal negative issue for Zim. And it should go without saying, you know, if you look at their balance sheet, you see their cash balances as well, right? This is not a company that is on the wire in any circumstance. At the end of Q1, I estimate they're going to have, and they're going to report these numbers in about 2 weeks. So by the time the podcast is out, these numbers are probably public anyways. But my estimate is they're going to have around $25 in cash reported as of 31 March. And again, by the time they report that, they'll have another $8 or $10 more, right? That's Q2 pro forma.
Yeah,
so I mean, this company is drowning in cash. No debt, zero conventional debt either.
Yeah. Well, it's all off balance sheet, right? If you were to true up the leases, you would call that some form of debt.
Right. But you'd also have to give them credit, of course, for the right of use. And it's kind of like, you know, renting a warehouse for 10 years or renting an office for 5 years or something. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's interesting. I was not that afraid of a recession. But then thanks to the Twitter folks for explaining to me. I don't know. I guess I am a little bit concerned. Well, I guess I'm actually concerned about what... you know, rates putting a slowing on the housing market does, because there's a paper that I'll drop in the show notes. But it's basically like the business cycle is the consumer cycle. And if you look at on the margin, a lot of that is housing. And, housing's got a big multiplier effect. So we're trying to slow down house price appreciation. But then if you depress existing home sales, do you have the remodel activity? That said, I do watch the lumber market some, and the lumber market would seem to say that activity is pretty strong. So who the hell knows, man? These are hard questions.
Well, you know, housing is way outside my lane, so I won't contribute anything else to that particular line of discussion. But I will... you know, agree with you that I have seen a massive amount of armchair global macroeconomists coming out on Twitter. Yeah. And, you know, it's kind of amusing. Yeah.
I guess I like to think about it, but I also know that whatever I say is going to be pretty wrong.
Well, that's true for any isolated predictor. So don't feel too badly about that. We always have to take the averages of all the predictions, and even the average is wrong. So
that's right. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So then when we were talking, you had said, you know, some of these contracted. So like the people that are leasing to Zim, right? Is that, that's the lessor or the
lessee? That's correct. Yeah.
I always mess that up.
Yeah, no, those are the owners. So yeah, the Costamares or the Global Ship Leases or the Danaos Corps, those companies. Yeah.
Yeah. So that, that was an area that you said, you know, is closer to, if I'm familiar with airlines like AerCap or whatever.
Exactly. That's it. That's basically a perfect analogy. Yep.
Do you want to explain kind of how you're thinking about those?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. And for the folks who might be familiar with something like AerCap, the ship owners are even more interesting because not only do they lease the ships to companies like Zim or Maersk or other liners, Matson's a U.S. liner that some folks might be familiar with, they also operate them. They provide the captains and the crewing. So it's an additional layer of sort of specialization, right? AerCap is purely finance. These guys are finance and operators. So they really understand how to maneuver the ship and upgrade it and care for it. And it's a full service lease, if you will. I'm really bullish on a few of those because it's just a simple locked in discounted cash flow sort of scenario. And so I look at a company like Danaos Corp. That's one of my top ones. Global Ship Lease, GSL, is another one. Both of those companies right now trade below the value of their locked in free cash flows, plus like the residual demolition value of their fleet. So what I mean by that is if you just took a company like Danaos Corp, DAC, and they simply operated the ships they have on the fixed contracts that they've already signed at the rates they've already signed them for, at the end of each one of those contracts, if they got the ship back and the market was terrible and they simply demolished it and got rid of it, you would end up with more money just on that scenario than the stock trades at today. Danaos Corp is, I mean, it's been a terrible market day set, and I don't have the quote right in front of me, but it's around $80, mid-80s. And the number of Danaos Corp's locked in cash flows plus demolition is roughly 115, 120, depends on what sort of discount rate you apply, right? If you want to do 8%, 10%, 12%, whatever you want to apply to that, it's around $115, $120 just in like that worst case bearish scenario. And so this company is massively, in my opinion, massively underpriced because folks don't quite understand it. You know, they treat it like a derivative on the freight markets. So when folks get nervous about the global economy, a stock like DAC, it dropped all the way back from 107. It hit a 52-week high about a month ago, fell all the way back from 107 all the way back to the mid-70s because folks were panicking, you know, about just the imminent global recession because of the Federal Reserve and all that sort of thing. And the reality is nothing really changed at Danaos Corp. The contracts are still locked in. They have world-class counterparties. And see, that's the biggest risk with a company like Danaos Corp is that, you know, how strong is your counterparty? And is your counterparty going to honor their obligations? Well, the liners are stronger than they have ever been in modern history. And they are drowning in billions of dollars of cash flow. They have paid off substantially, basically all of their risky debt. A company like Zim, you know, is sitting on, we just talked about, sitting on $25 per share, 2.5, pushing $3 billion in cash is sitting there. Companies like Maersk are stronger than they've ever been. So the counterparty risk is close to nil. And so you can take those, you know, 3, 4, 5 year charters and very high investment grade certainty that those will be paid.
You know what I liked about the Zim interview that you did? You asked the guy, why isn't he buying his stock back? And he was basically like, well, we just IPO'd, right? Like it wouldn't feel right to buy in shares, which I kind of like that answer. I don't know that I agree with it, but there's a moralistic bend to that I kind of like. But
how often have you seen a stock that IPOs at 15 or whatever dollar? At IPO is at 15, and in 13 months, they pay out $21.50 in dividends. I don't think that's ever happened in modern history. I might be wrong.
The dividend yield's like 120%.
I don't think there's ever been a company in modern history. Now, I say modern history because way back with like, I don't know, the railroad companies in like 1885 or something, maybe. But I don't think there's ever been a company in modern history, I mean, the last like 100 years, that has IPO'd and paid out, what is that, 130, 140% of its IPO value in 13 months? I don't think that's ever happened.
Yeah, that's wild.
It's insane, yeah. The IPO wasn't done for traditional IPO reasons. And the IPO wasn't done because they needed to raise cash. the IPO was done because it was a private company who had an owner who wanted to diversify a little bit. It had a bank that owned a large portion of it from the restructuring, didn't really want to own it anymore. And they just wanted liquidity. It was the same reason Blackstone went public. It was this 20 years ago now. It's been a while. But Blackstone IPO'd in the mid-2000s for the same reason. The founder, Schwarzman, wanted liquidity. And so that's what made Zim so interesting. And that's something, if you go back and read my initial write-up on the IPO, that was something I seized on. I was like, look, these guys accepted a ridiculously underbilled IPO pricing because they really don't even care. They just want liquidity.
Huh. Interesting.
The IPO 10%. I mean, it was a small IPO. The IPO'd, I think it was like 14% of the float. Most IPOs have a larger float. And they actually minimized the float on purpose because the valuation was so terrible on IPO. They didn't really care. They just wanted a publicly listed stock symbol.
Huh.
Yeah. Inside.
So what, they had a lockup, and then after their lockup for a little while, they could come out and sell?
Exactly. They had a 6-month lockup on everybody. And that was like the big bear case back when, it's funny, like you can go back and read my write-ups on this thing. You can look back at it. But when Zim IPO'd at 15, they dropped to like 11 the next day. It was peak GameStop. That is when GameStop was like going to a million a share, and you know, all the hedge funds were going to blow up. And I mean, for like 3 days, there were some like viable, valid concerns that like this GameStop thing could bring down the market. I don't know how many people subscribe to that, but it was like one of those like tail risk scenarios. And Zim IPO'd in this thing. So they went 15, they dropped all the way to 11. But anyways, the bear case against Zim right off the bat wasn't even economical. It wasn't even like, oh, these guys are going to not make earnings, or oh, these guys are overpriced. The bear case was like, you know, 85% of the stock is locked up for 6 months. And in 6 months, there's going to be a rug pull and a dump. And I mean, I just thought that was ridiculous because the economics were so good. But that was legitimately, Bill, that was the bear case. Well, the lockup came and went, and, you know, we saw what happened.
Well, when you're making that much money, it doesn't even matter.
No, it doesn't. I think folks are just so used to these tech lockups on these like ridiculously overvalued companies that they sort of put Zim in the same bucket.
So, you know, it's kind of weird because I look at those boats sitting off the coast of China and I think, well, those are probably empty, right? Like they're on their backhaul leg waiting to dock. Like, how does this work? How does a shipping company make money when a ship is just sitting out there empty, waiting to come into the port?
No, great question. And just a caveat on the picture of all the ships, because I've seen that one circulating. It's been circulating for a couple of weeks. It is true that the backlog outside Chinese ports like Shanghai and Ningwa and some of the others is almost a record high. It's very high. However, one of the pictures that circulated around that shows it's like a scatter plot of
yeah,
ships.
Dude, it's like there's boats everywhere.
Boats everywhere. A lot of those are like buoys and fishing boats, and like it's a poorly labeled, like the scale is all jacked up. You know, there's big red circles for like fishing boats, you know. So like the picture itself is hyperbole, but no, it's a good question.
We're correcting fake news out here.
Yeah, you know, I got to be, you know, fix what I can, right? I mean, because folks see this and they're like, oh my God, it's insane. Like,
I sent it to you. I was like, what's going on here? And you were like, it's a bunch of fishing boats and stuff. I was like, okay, yeah, that makes sense.
It's a crazy picture. But part of it, again, I said earlier, when every like crazy story, there's always a little bit of truth. And so the congestion factor is indeed true. I mean, we're 30 or 40% above where we should be normally. In regards to your original question, Bill, who gets paid? So the ship chartering companies, the owning companies like Danaos Corp and Global Ship Lease, the ones that I'm really, really favorable on right now, they get paid regardless. It doesn't matter if the ship's sitting there for 6 months, if it's going back and forth, if it's going in circles, they get paid. Just like you're renting an apartment building or a truck or anything else, you get paid. The companies like Zim, they get paid for taking cargo from point A to point B. So a company like Zim is going to see their volumes go down. And we already saw this last year, right? Last year had a lot of congestion. However, the congestion also artificially reduces supply, which keeps rates, you know, you can say artificial if you want, but it keeps rates very strong. So, you know, you're going to take a 10, maybe 20% hit on volumes, but you're going to double or triple your rates. And I've done this sort of public math example before, but if you take 2 times 0.8, you get 1.6. If you take 3 times 0.8, you get, 2.4. And that's a lot bigger than one, right? So the net impact to Zim,
the math checks out.
The math checks, right? And I mean, damn, I'm in this PhD program and I struggle to multiply 0.8 by 3 sometimes.
But well, public math sucks, man.
It does. But point being, this congestion is good for Zim, but it does kind of hurt their throughput, right? It is unequivocally good. Like, without a doubt, it is good for every single ship owner and lessor because they're getting paid no matter what happens. And another company I've talked about a lot, the box lessors, even more boring. I mean, this is the most boring company you can imagine. It is very similar to an AerCap, is a company like Textainer, TGH. And they own and finance the metal 40-foot metal boxes. It's just super boring business. But those metal boxes are on 7, 8, 9, even 12-year leases. They get paid every day. It's like $1.50 a day, you know? And they get paid, you know, $1.50 a day or whatever the rate might be for 10 years straight. And so congestion and disruption and all sorts of things, unequivocally a good thing for box lessors and for ship lessors. So the fact that these stocks are all down over the last month, it's crazy in my opinion, Bill.
So why is it a good thing for the box lessors? Is it because there are fewer boxes hitting the market, and then in the longer term it creates a tighter market?
It's exactly. And so each year there's about 6 or 7% of turnover, right? Boxes that come off their old leases and get signed on new ones. A lot of times what happens historically is they would finance these boxes and they're usually good for 14 to 15 years. And so the first contract would usually be about half life, anywhere from 6 to 8 years. And then as that lease expires, the container, as it were, is returned to the company and they can extend that lease. And usually the extensions are done in a negotiation that the container never actually changes hands, right? That'd just be a waste of logistics. But the point being is when the market is really, really tight, the container liner companies are going to offer, or maybe not offer, but willing to accept very high costs on those lease turnovers. So it has those old contracts, and every year there's 6 or 7% turnover of those containers. So that's why the extremely tight utilization situation is very good for a company like Textainer or Triton, because not only do their rollovers go on higher and higher rates, any sort of new growth that they're underwriting, that they're financing, is going to be at very, very strong levels. And so that's why I say they're winners. You're right that the fixed volumes are fixed, so they're not going up or down, but the rollovers are going to be at higher rates.
Yeah. Interesting. So with all this happening, I mean, should we all be expecting higher for longer in shipping rates and the impact on consumer products, do you think?
A lot of that's going to depend on the strength of the consumer demand side of the equation. I mean, last year was both ends working at the same time. You had the consumer demand was relentless, and you had a completely jacked up global supply situation. And that's why you had the all-time record high rates that we saw last September, last October, both ends working in conjunction. Right now in 2022, we're seeing consumer demand moderate, if not outright slow down, but we're seeing the supply side be as bad as ever. And so right now it's really the supply side doing all the heavy lifting. And so as we turn into the summer, it's going to be a matter of how strong does that consumer come back and how quickly or how efficiently does the supply side recover? And so what I'm looking at this summer is really two things. One, besides consumer demand is obviously the underpinning, but what I'm looking at on the supply side is when will China reopen? When will they, you know, get past the zero COVID policy and completely reopen their ports and their manufacturing hubs? And then secondly, there's a massive West Coast union. It's called ILWU, International Longshoremen and Warehouse Union. That contract, it's a 7-year labor contract. It expires June 30th. So we're, 7 weeks away as we're recording this. And last time, 7 years ago, when they renewed this thing, it took months to negotiate. And there was a multi-week sort of like almost like a sit-in. Maybe they did like, it wasn't an outright strike, but there was like disruptions and all sorts of stuff going on. Well, this is 7 weeks away. The opening negotiations don't even start until next week. And the union is in the strongest position they've ever been. I mean, like, supply chains are in max focus, liner profitability, port profitability are record highs. There's a lot of political attention on this. There's an administration, for better or worse, I don't want to make political judgments, but there's an administration that has historically been very union supportive. So, you know, this union is in the most powerful position they've ever been in. And this contract expires in 7 weeks. So what happens if there's a month or two of disruptions at the port? I mean, just imagine that, Bill. You saw what happened last year. Everyone was working as hard as they could, and you saw what happened. Now imagine if everyone's working half as hard as they could, right? It could be a very, very interesting summer, even if consumers aren't full force.
It's going to be interesting to watch. I have zero clue, obviously, how this all plays out. But, you know, seeing trucking roll over a little bit and then seeing all this congestion, it's, I don't know. It's a wild movie, I guess is the best way to describe it.
I do want to throw one quick caveat into the trucking story, because I've followed Craig Fuller's work very closely. And I know I think you had him on your podcast recently.
Yeah.
The trucking market is much, much different than the ocean liner market. And I'm sure Craig mentioned this on his discussion. The ocean liner business is highly consolidated. There's really two major global alliances which control over 50% of the trade. So I got to be careful. I sound like a congressional witness here testifying or something. You know, break these guys up. But no, it's similar to global air traffic. There's global air traffic alliances as well. It's actually efficiency creating in the long run. But in the short run, it creates a lot of cost discipline. So you have two major alliances control over half the trade. The top five liners control 65% of global capacity. Top five companies, 2/3 of the market. Top 10 companies, 85% of the market. I'll give you one anecdote to how crazy the U.S. trucker market is. I mean, this thing is insane, Bill. During February, and this is from FreightWaves, I think it was from a FreightWaves article. In February alone, so February 2022, there was more than 40,000 new "quote unquote trucking companies established."
Yeah,
40,000.
Yeah, that's what he was saying.
Oh my gosh.
And he said those are obviously the guys that are going to get killed first, right? Because it's a bunch of guys that were like,
yeah,
and they were going through the truck stop and they were talking to their friends, and their friends are like, "You're a sucker driving for JB Hunt. You got to buy your own rig and, you know, sell it spot, and then you flood the market, and then you got to work through that." So yeah, no doubt,
it was a different dynamic. Like it was a chasing the you know, bubble rates and get rich quick schemes and all sorts of crazy stuff. And I feel bad, really bad for some of the folks that got sucked into that. You know, it's always the folks that can't afford it, right? That get sucked in and hurt the worst. So it's actually a really sad story. So I don't want to, you know, gloat or anything, but it's a crazy market. And I don't think there's a whole lot of parallels to be gained from that versus what's going on with ocean shipping.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think what I'm interested in is you've got that dynamic going on, and then you've also got the COVID zero policy in China, and like, I don't know. And then with the ports potentially going on strike or half working or whatever that looks like, I don't know. Like, the goods in, let's call it like July 31st, it's going to be interesting to see what inventory levels look like.
It's going to be crazy, Bill. And every year, the peak ocean freight seasonality is always from like end of July through October, November. That's the peak global shipping season.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah, holiday stocking, right? Pre-holiday stocking.
Yeah.
And the lull, the trough of the season is always, every year, without fail, it's like January/February through about April and May. So when folks say, I've seen all these crazy headlines saying, oh, shipping rates are falling or shipping rates are down, they're comparing like October of last year, which is the peak seasonality, to like April of this year, which is like the ultimate trough. And so like, be careful, guys, be careful, because if you look at April of this year to April, and you remember what happened last year, April of this year to April of last year, the rates are twice as high this year. And that's crazy. In fact, I'm almost more concerned, Bill, that those rates are just too high. Like I'm more concerned, Bill, if anything, just as a U.S. citizen, right? I'm concerned that if those rates are this high now and China reopens and the U.S. consumer doesn't, you know, fall on their ass and ILWU is striking, I don't even know if I want to see that. I mean, it would just be, the rates would be insane. So I don't know. It's a lot of what ifs, a lot of balloons in the air, but yeah.
Well, I was talking to somebody who is a macro investor that listens. Shout out to you if you're listening now. He subs to your service, actually. I don't want to name him, but he was saying about like he grew up in Brazil and he watched what an inflationary spiral had done. And he was just talking about how important it is to not let that get out of control. And I don't even really fancy myself a historian, and I don't mean that in an ignorant way. I just mean like I'm just that it's not where my attention normally goes. I more learned from talking to some people. I realized there's maybe problems with that, but it gave me an appreciation of what a problem this could really be if we get in one of these, like, you know, stuff is tight, so prices go up, so labor gets raises, so stuff is tight. Like, right. it can really get away from you. And then stopping that and having some sort of a soft landing can be really, really difficult.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Which is where we may currently be.
Yeah. We're in a dangerous.
Or not.
Yeah. I mean, we're in a tight global predicament. And I don't want to, again, get out of my lane too much. But, you know, a 0.5% raise that happened yesterday, was announced yesterday, and the tightening, the quantitative tightening that's going to start this summer. Man, if anything, you know, if you're bearish on your investments because of that, like, what the hell are you investing in? Like, you got to get better investments. Like, this Fed raise and tightening is, if anything, it's a year overdue, you know? And,
yeah.
And so I'm an energy and shipping guy, and I am not, stocks will do what stocks do, right, Bill? And for traders, like, traders have a different time frame and different considerations. But yeah, as an investor, I'm not worried about the QT. I'm not worried about the 0.5% raise. I'm not worried about another 0.5 around the next corner. It's overdue. It needs to happen. We have to rein this thing in before we risk, like you mentioned, an inflationary spiral and things get out of control. I am happy that we're doing the raises we're doing.
Logan. I love how he looks at it. He looks at it from a housing perspective, right? And his point is, like, he wanted 25%. He figured if we could go 4 years with 25% price appreciation, that would be, you know, a quasi healthy housing market given his forecast. It would not be healthy, but it'd be like manageable. Well, we did that in year one, and then we did like another 15 to 20 in year two. So he's like, you got to stop this. Like, we can't have that become the norm.
Yeah.
So I tend to agree with you. This is one of those healing moments. I think the interesting thing about some of these companies whose valuations move a lot based on rates, I've told myself, and this may be incorrect, but I think it's true. You probably have a better idea than I do. You've been doing this a lot longer. There's a lot of guys that trade acceleration, deceleration, right? And I think a lot of those guys are pretty levered. So I think you have like that going on combined with a number of passive people. So there's not like a lot of active owners of the businesses. And then if you are an owner of the business, with that, like with the duration that a lot of those businesses require. I mean, if you just look at how long bonds trade, it's not like, it kind of makes sense, but I've always said that living through that would be really tough. And I think it was a lot of fun on the upside. I don't know how people are doing on the downside, but I hope a lot of them have conviction. I hope a lot of them are right. And then they got to have the right LPs, because the path dependency of you being right plus your LPs making money plus you making money, those are different questions, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, there's just a lot of companies out there that are phenomenal, just fantastic companies. And you know, the Peter Lynch kind of model of like, buy what you love and buy what's good. But the valuations just, they just don't make sense. And I'm not an expert in these companies, right? I don't want to embarrass myself and name companies I'm even thinking of talking about, but think of the FANGs, right? The big ones. Great companies. Nothing negative to say about them, but the math to make a discounted cash flow model work, I mean, your discount rate's got to be like 2%. It's just crazy math. And I think, you know, as we're seeing the interest rates rise, I'm not saying anything negative about the company. It's not my expertise, but you know, you see corrections in stocks like Amazon, and that's going to happen when you have interest rates rising and a discounted cash flow model that depended on tiny, tiny interest rates forever.
Yeah, I think some of the valuations also depend on assuming certain things about growth spend that we'll see if that's true or not, right? But I get more nervous about some of those hypergrowth companies than I do the FANGs, but famous last words.
Yeah, well, there's a difference. You have a company like a FANG company, like an Amazon, you know, and I, again, not my expertise. I'm just speaking generally, but, you know, your downside, and it's already been, 45% down? And so your downside is survivable, right? Whereas a hyper-growth company, I mean, your downside is 100% loss and never a recovery, right? Your downside is bankruptcy and delisting, right? So, like, there's a different sort of downside. Like, I don't think, again, we might listen to this podcast in 10 years and, like, you know, things have changed in a crazy way. But, like, you know, I don't think you're ever going to see a Google or an Amazon or a Microsoft or probably even a Meta, Facebook, go 90% down or bankrupt, right? But almost everything that's in like an ARK ETF, you know, survivability is like a key question.
Yeah. Or it's got 60% forward returns. You know, yeah. It all depends who you're talking to.
Hey, everyone can make a napkin model, right?
Yeah, that's right. One thing that interests me about your models, or at least the sector that you cover, is the residual values are somewhat supported by inflation. It's like a reasonably decent inflation hedge in scrap value, I would think.
Yeah, that's true, especially for the companies that have a fixed leverage, right? All their debt is hedged or fixed, and the ship has a shorter, you know, charter, a couple of years, and then after the charter, it's either it can be recontracted or it can be demolished. It's hard to imagine a better inflation hedge than something like that.
Yeah. Well, I got nothing else. I just kind of wanted to have you back on for an update. You have anything else you want to talk about?
No, Bill, it's always great to talk with you. It's always fun. And I hope your listeners enjoyed this and have learned some stuff. If you post,
I've got a
link,
number of requests for you. So right. I know at least that number of people will be happy. The rest, I don't know.
Hey, people have been really, really kind and it's good to work with such good folks. Something like Twitter, you know, when I got more involved with Twitter, this was just like a year and a half, 2 years ago. And I was nervous about, you know, it's a toxic environment and social media, but, you know, folks by and large have been pleasant to deal with, and that's good. Of course, we'll have to see what happens if there's a downturn. Maybe they won't be so pleasant.
Well, yeah.
But no, I mean, by and large, people have been very professional. It's always good to come on a podcast like yours with reasoned, intelligent questions and a good debate. I think really, Bill, the closing comments, if you were, as it were, would be things to watch for the summer. And I think we already hit them, but just so they're concise in 30 seconds, I think we have to watch that EU embargo of Russian oil and see what happens with that, if it's serious or if it's just kind of pie in the sky. If it's serious and it actually does happen this summer, this fall, you got to watch crude tanker rates. Those could be phenomenal. And then secondly, on the container ship side, you got to watch the China reopening with zero COVID, and you got to watch domestically what's going on with the ILWU contract that expires June 30th. So those are the two kind of actionable must-watch, get your popcorn out items for this summer in those two sectors. So maybe next fall we'll talk more and we'll see what happened.
Yeah, man. We'll have a follow-up. I look forward to it.
Fantastic. Thanks, Bill.
All right. Thank you. Have a good one. Thanks.